Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, when author Susan Faludi surveys the cultural landscape of America since the horrors of 9/11. She sees a nation of women and men grasping at reassuring old myths about manly men and nurturing maternal women. She says America, in effect, went backwards after 9/11, way back. From box cutters to bows and arrows and old nightmares and gender roles of the American frontier. This hour on Point, feminist author and America watcher Susan Faludi and her analysis of our terror dream. Did 9/11 send us hurtling back to the frontier stockades and primal fears of Indian raiding parties? Did it really scare us into a rollback of women's rights? Is myth and history, are they that strong, that relevant? Joining me now from San Francisco is Susan Faludi. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author. In 1991, she published Backlash and described what she called the undeclared war against American women. In 1999, she came out with Stiffed, The Betrayal of the American Man. Her new book is The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America. Susan Faludi, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As usual, you come out with a big pointed theme and give us the basics of it. I mean, I've tried to summarize it there, but how do you put it? What do you say has happened here?
I thought you did an excellent job, actually. I wrote this book to try and understand what happened to us after 9/11. Because when you go back and look at how you look at our reaction, you realize something very strange. Our response didn't seem to be a reaction to the actual threat. We fell into this odd kind of fever dream where we had politicians reenacting a Wild West drama, spouting vigilante cowboy rhetoric about smoking them out of their holes. Mm. And our pundits were saying things like we should shoot them between the eyes, that we should use, you know, frontier vengeance, that the war on terror was back to our frontier wars fighting the Indians. And these were comments made in the Washington Post, Atlantic Monthly, the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, John Wayne kept coming up. And there was all this talk about scared housewives wanting protection and men wanting to defend their family home from attack. So here we have hijackers aiming planes at the symbols of our military and commercial power, yet as a culture, we're reacting as if this is an attack on the American home and hearth. So I set out to try and make some sense of this peculiar response.
And you go from that, was what somebody called the sort of buckskin bravado response, references to John Wayne and masculinity. I mean, that's already one piece, and we'll look at that, how strong the so-called maybe master narrative might be here. But then you go further and say that putting the John Wayne face forward meant putting the women back. You ask, why were we willing ourselves back onto a frontier where pig-tailed damsels clutched rag dolls and prayed for a male avenger to return them to the home? Was it really as bad as all that? Have American women really had that much backsliding since 2001?
No, and I'm actually, this is not a book about what 9/11 did to women or did to men for that matter. Mm. What I'm talking about is how 9/11 revealed a reflex that's deeply embedded in our culture. I'm not talking about individual behavior. I'm talking about how we responded as a culture, the media, the political culture, our popular culture. And as far as pigtailed damsels, what I was referring to in that passage was that after 9/11, we went on this, our culture went on this desperate hunt for heroes. And, you know, there were plenty of people who behaved courageously and who rushed to Ground Zero, who, you know, drove across the country to see how they could help. But because of the nature of the attack, which was catastrophic, there were few opportunities for effective heroism. If you were in the towers, you were either instantly killed if you were above the fire line, or you, with very few exceptions, walked down in your own 2 feet. And obviously no one remained from the planes to rescue. So instead, we created as a culture this arbitrary designations by sex. So the heroes became the men who died, especially the firefighters, and a handful of the men on Flight 93, who were essentially victims, who then were turned into heroes. And the culture anointed as the victims the 9/11 widows, you know, the women whose husbands had died.
You know, you quote Richard Slotkin right at the front of the book, of course, famous historian of the American West, from his book Regeneration Through Violence, and where he says, a people unaware of its myths is likely to continue living by them, though the world around the people may change and demand changes in their psychology, their worldview, their ethics, and their institutions. That's a big statement. What is the core myth that you see Americans touching back to here? Is it really stockades and raiding parties, and that literally out of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries and interactions with Native Americans?
Well, the mythology is more out of the end of the 18th and the 19th century, and it's a reaction to our most foundational experience. As much as we kept hearing after 9/11 that these attacks had never happened to us before, that America is not vulnerable to assault on home soil, which in recent times is certainly the case. But if you go back and look at history, our earliest history, you realize something very important. This has happened to us before, over and over, and its happening was essential to the formation of the American character. I mean, for the first at least 200 years of early colonial American life, the prevailing reality was being attacked on quote-unquote home soil, and especially on homes. Now, granted, this was home soil that the settlers had taken away from the native population, but looking at it from the settlers' point of view, which is where the mythology springs from, they felt they were being attacked by people they demonized as non-Christian, non-white terrorists. These attacks were not only traumatic, they proved humiliating over and over again to the settler community, because over and over, leaders, militias, husbands were not able to protect families in frontier towns. Between the late 17th and early 18th century, more than a quarter of women who were taken captive in New England were never rescued, and a remarkable 60% of girls were never rescued. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, how did we respond as a culture to this foundational experience? And the answer is, we responded, but largely by covering it up with the creation of a national security myth, a myth of the nation as unassailable and protected by 101 Daniel Boones and John Waynes rescuing little girls. And that's the story we told ourselves over and over again, of these tales of triumph in the Great Plains, these tales of, John Wayne rescuing little Debbie and the searchers, all the way down to the post-9/11 informed film Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds, where you have Tom Cruise as the dad protecting his girl from Martian attack and a molester in a rural homestead.
So you see that history, those foundational experiences, as you put it, as so strong that when the United States faces a moment of attack in the 21st century, all of the progress in gender roles and expectations that we like to think has gone on over so many decades just gets washed away in a big Daniel Boone wave?
No, the progress, I mean, I need to distinguish here between individual private behavior and a public reflexive reaction. And it's not like individual women decided to go home.
But that's what we are as a country, right? We're an agglomeration of individual women and men. individuals.
Well, but our culture is a very different beast. Our culture is the media telling women, as it did after 9/11, over and over again. There were a raft of so-called trend stories saying that women should go back to the home, that women should get married, that it was their quote-unquote patriotic duty to have babies. The New York Times, in the first month and a half after 9/11, ran four stories saying that single women should give up their that single women would be inspired by the attacks to rush to the wedding altar. One of these stories actually advised women to take as their model the Twin Towers, which the story claimed were like a Mr. and Mrs., a longtime couple caught up in a 30-year romance.
Oh, boy, sitting on a planetary wedding cake. Do you think Americans, women took that advice? I mean, did they see themselves huddling in the Conestoga wagon, or did they just, you know, go blithely on with their careers and lives and as they had?
Well, it created a climate in which women who raised their voices to dissent were slapped down in particularly personal and moralistic ways. Look at what happened to Susan Sontag in The New Yorker, or Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, who simply said, perhaps we could learn a few hard truths from these wrongful deaths. Or Katha Pollitt in The Nation, who suggested that flag waving might not be the way to go. Furthermore, there were an alarming number of commentaries and articles after 9/11 saying that feminism, that women and specifically feminists had undermined the country's resolve to fight, had weakened the military. And then you also saw women's voices beginning to disappear from right after 9/11 from op-ed pages and news programs.
We're talking this hour with feminist and Uber America watcher Susan Faludi about where fear has taken the USA. She says back to frontier myths for everybody and a gingham backseat for women. She joins us this hour from San Francisco. Her new book is The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post 9/11 America. Let's take a call from Albert in Worcester, Massachusetts. Albert, you're on the air.
Well, Phineas and Tom, the master Uber talk show.
Oh, boy.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom and Susan.
Okay.
I think America was never far from the myth. Most nations, most people never are. Yeah, we like our men manly and our women protected. I mean, I'm gay. I like to have the woman in me protected. But also, I really feel that Americans need to become centrist. Each individual American needs to incorporate that in their myth. We need to not necessarily just, as Ms. Faludi does, encourage the individual to have more freedom, nor, as, say, Mr. Bill O'Reilly does, to be close to the center because we identify with the center because we don't want the rules to change. We need to do both. We need to be little heroes in each moment. There was an ancient, like, sanitarium in England. I forget the details of this historical story, where the doctor told the patients to say to themselves, every day and every way I'm getting better and better. Every day and every day way we must be more and more heroes to our capacity, and then we take the day off of being a hero, and maybe in a day or two again you'll be a hero.
But Albert, when we reach to be heroes, do we necessarily become buckskin Daniel Boones again? Does it mean women, you know, sort of necessarily get shoved back?
I don't know if women necessarily get stuck back. I know that there are women in Iraq, Iran. I'm saying that, and I think what Ms. Faludi is seeing is that this is a core myth. We need to develop. We need to develop with, but incorporate to grow beyond. I'd like to think that a man can be a man, a woman can be a woman, but sometimes a man can be some little needy. Or I'm an adult autistic, so I know that I've learned to deal with emotions and stuff, and that I never thought of. I never thought about relationships. So I never missed friendships. You know, so I'm learning to incorporate that, to be friendly sometimes, to take time for myself other times instead of just doing stuff and then go there by myself and then that's it.
But find a good balance right there. And we hear that, Albert, and we thank you for that call. Let me get one more from Hampton, Virginia. Forrest, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Forrest. I'm really enjoying the show.
Thanks. What do you know?
Well, I'm puzzled by her initially by her combination of the myth of rescue versus the reality about settlers being under attack long ago and being powerless to recover people.
Mm-hmm.
I think really the myth of rescue and John Wayne, an individual individually getting the bad guy. The reality is, very quickly after settlers were settled, there was no Native opposition. The other guys were eliminated from the playing field. And the morality of that is a separate issue, but there was no long period of time when settlers were under attack by Indians.
Well, but it was a matter of hundreds of years as a frontier pushed forward. Are you saying, Forrest, you don't buy that the myth still propels American thinking, emotion?
I'm saying that I think that is that's a bad combination. But the reason I called is our response to that threat back 200 years ago or 100 years ago as you go further west, the settlers directly eliminated the problem. And it may have been terrible for the people on their side, but they did it. Our response to 9/11 is something more like an allergic reaction, where there's a huge response, but the attack is on ourselves. We've made changes on ourselves in how we address the world and how we operate domestically that have made us weaker and not stronger. The settlers, when they didn't stop farming and build forts around their farms or around their houses, they went out and eliminated the problem. What we've done in 9/11 is we have done all these changes to our economy. We've changed our travel system. We've done all kinds of things. We've got a war in Iraq, and our enemies are stronger, and we're worse for it.
Interesting. And eliminate the problem, of course, quite a loaded phrase when you think about what that meant. Susan, let me get one more because I've got to get a woman in here with you. It's Susan Faludi, after all. Lori's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a question for the author.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how different 9/11 and anxiety about terrorism is. It seems as though it's just a new trope for an old anxiety, replacing things like the atomic bomb or fear of the Cold War.
Interesting. Good. Susan, what do you say?
Yes, I actually wrote about that in the book because that's a key central point. This is a mythology that never goes away. It goes underground at periods, and then it becomes more difficult to recognize and perhaps more dangerous as a result. But in periods where we feel threatened, particularly on home soil, this mythology is reactivated. We reach for it as our consoling fiction. And the Cold War was a classic example of that, which I wrote about in The Terror Dream. What's so striking is after we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as we entered the atomic age, we again responded with this trumped-up domestic drama. There was a raft of stories about our men, American men, too emasculated now. Believe it or not, this is what they were agonizing about in the early late 40s and early 50s, that women were too powerful. No less notable than Arthur Schlesinger devoted an awful lot of ink to this. And the response was, again, a kind of frontier response of, we're going to build these fallout shelters and men have to stock up on guns and protect their little women in the fallout shelters where women will be canning and taking care of the children. This was a message that came straight from the Federal Civil Defense Administration, and which actually appointed a sort of speaker to go around and talk about how the family ranch, the suburban family ranch, was the new bunker and fortress against threat. So you see this story reshaping over and over again in American history.
Mm. We'll look at what you might propose instead, but I want to hear from someone of the many media sources that you cite in the book as evidence of this kind of reversion to master narrative and national myth that you describe. You cite a column by syndicated columnist Mona Charon. She's been on our show any number of times. It was headlined, "Hooray for Men." You say that she anticipated the end of the old reign of feminism. You quote her, just one line from that column that says, "Perhaps the new climate of danger from evil men, will quiet the anti-male agitation we've endured for so long." Mona Charon joins us right now from Great Falls, Virginia. She's author of Do-Gooders most recently. Mona Charon, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So here's Susan's big theory. 9/11 threw us, as other crises have thrown us, back into the arms of national myth. And she says people like you welcome that as a way to sort of, I don't know, get over feminism and put men back high in the saddle.
Well, I really don't think that Susan Faludi has proved her case at all. When I look around the world and I look at our country in the wake of 9/11, I see that we have a woman who stands a very good chance of being elected the next president. I see a woman Secretary of State, a woman leader of the Speaker of the House, a woman president of Harvard. The list goes on and on. There has been no change in the number of women in the workforce. There hasn't been a race back to the home. Ms. Faludi says, well, I'm not talking about the behavior of people. I'm talking about the messages of that the media has sent. But I haven't sensed that at all. I sense, yes, there has been a response culturally to 9/11, but it's a pretty complex one, and I don't think it's monolithic at all. I mean, on the one hand, you have movies being made that sort of criticize the war on terror. That's one part of the cultural response. Right now, we have several movies out that take issue with the way we're conducting the war. And you have others who are saying, yes, hooray for men. I said that in my column, meaning that there are times when the manly virtues are really important. And there are such things as manly virtues. That doesn't denigrate women.
And when you raise that, do you feel yourself falling back, leaning back on national myth from the year, I don't know, 1799?
Certainly not. I do think that in the last 30 to 40 years, there has been a bit of men have been given a really rough time. I mean, they have been accused of being batterers and of being disruptive to the family and of being authoritarians, and they've had a really rough run for the last number of years, mostly at the hands of feminists. And so what I was trying to say was, maybe this will remind us that there are a lot of manly virtues that are useful and necessary in this world.
Susan Faludi, did you have any of that response on the morning of 9/11 or in the weeks after? Oh, it's time to bring back the manly men, that they have their time and purpose?
Well, actually, I got a phone call on the afternoon of 9/11 from a reporter who said he was doing a reaction story, and then mostly seemed to be eager to give me his reaction, which was, as he put it, well, this sure pushes feminism off the map. And I actually got quite a few phone calls in the weeks afterward from reporters, both male and female, doing trend stories on how, as one of them put it, 9/11 would make women more feminine, and another on how women would want brawny men to protect them from attack in the home. Where to begin?
Monacharan looks around and says, hey, where is the evidence? We've got women in high-profile positions all over the place, including next president of the United States. You say it's not about individuals, but there ought to be some top-level evidence.
First of all, I reiterate, and as I say on page 13 of the book, this is not a book about what 9/11 did to women. And as much as Monacharan and other pundits want to argue that is not what I'm talking about in the book. I'm talking about how our myth, our response, our reach for myth damaged not women's situation or men's situation, but our political behavior. It silenced dissent. It deformed our politics, disfigured our national discussion, and it made us less safe, as one of the earlier callers pointed out.
That it silenced dissent?
There's, as I describe in great detail in the book, one critic after another was slammed for merely, let's just take Susan Sontag as one of many, many examples, who said in The New Yorker, a few shreds of historical awareness might be in order. For that, she was called morally deranged, idiot, belonged in the first circle of hell.
Is that different from what happened to Bill Maher or what happened to Steve Earle, the country singer, or other men, Susan?
There were men who were criticized too, but women in particular, and that is part of the silencing of dissent. I'm not saying just women.
It seems to me that when women are part of the national discussion, some of us make our living giving our opinions, and we run the risk of being criticized in return. that's part of the give and take of the public square.
There's one thing. There's public criticism. There's public debate, and there's public debate, and there's personal vicious attack, as we all know, and we all know the difference.
But I don't think women, I don't think there's any evidence that women are more viciously attacked for their opinions than men are.
Well, Susan has laid out quite a lot in the book that she describes it. But let me ask you, Mona, this. When you said, you know, perhaps this new climate of danger will quiet the anti-male agitation we've endured for so long, was that not on your part a kind of a smack against feminism, Mona? Did you consciously see it that way?
Yes, I did, because I think feminism has been very anti-male. But I also said in that very same column, do we cheer the courage and fortitude of women like that flight attendant who boiled water, preparing to use it as a weapon against the terrorists? You bet we do. But do we also recognize that physical strength in certain situations of danger like this has its importance? Yes, we do. The fact is, Richard Reed, and that was what I was writing about, Richard Reed, the would-be shoe bomber, was 6'4 and strong, and two flight attendants attempted to subdue him and were unable to do so because he was very big and strong. And it took some very big and strong men passengers who were on the plane to finally subdue him.
Were you sort of suggesting then, kind of Jerry Falwell style, that America invited 9/11 by weakening the self-image of... it's a question.
No, I'm sorry.
This was said again and again by the Independent Women's Forum, by many women in the conservative media, which I document in full in the book.
Not that we invited the attacks. Certainly not.
No. That feminist weakened that feminism. That the changes made to the military to advance women's position undermined our strength, that argument was made repeatedly.
I am familiar with the Women's Independent Women's Forum and with what they have argued about the military. I think those are discrete points, though. I mean, their argument is that political correctness and the desire to... to treat men and women exactly the same in the military, which definitely is a problem, has weakened military readiness. And I think that's a reasonable argument to make. It does not mean it's a huge leap, though, from that to say that they were arguing that women...
The Independent Women's Forum has a long agenda opposed to feminism that stretches from... affirmative action to family-friendly policies. So we don't want to debate the Independent Women's Forum today.
But I want to just ask Mona, if I may. Mona, what about the foundational myth, the kind of frontier attack and response myth that Susan Faludi looks at? I mean, we all know that is part of our national history, baggage, myth, but you can see it in a positive or negative sense. How do you see it? When we lean back on the kind of Daniel Boone, circle the wagons mythology, does that take us back in a negative way or not?
When I think of the founding stories of the country, I see it very differently. I don't see it as being a myth that encourages women to be weak and retiring. In fact, when you read stories about women on the frontier, for example, the Little House on the Prairie stories that I read to my three sons, even though all the characters in it are female, still very inspiring stuff and full of female courage and independence and ability to cope with a very difficult situation. There really, in fact, you could almost say there was no need for feminism on the frontier because women were doing everything, including fighting Indians. And with all due respect to the fact that, you know, that was a problematic issue, fighting Indians. Mm. But I'm just saying that I don't see those foundational myths, if you will, and I'm not sure that I would call them myths, but I don't see our stories of our frontier heritage as being one that encourages female passivity.
Mm. Susan Faludi, we'll be right back and hear more from you. Mona Charon, syndicated conservative columnist, author of Do-Gooders, How Liberals Hurt Those They Claim to Help. Thanks very much for being with us, Mona. We're talking this hour with feminist and America watcher Susan Faludi about where fear has taken the USA since 9/11. She says back to frontier myths for all, with men, again, very much up front. Her new book is The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in post 9/11 America. Tina's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Tina, you're on the air with Susan Faludi.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Susan. This is very exciting because when I heard this idea about this you know, sort of cultural fabric reasserting itself in response to 9/11, I remember being shocked in the months after 9/11 that most of the conversations in the media, especially with commentary, were coming from men. And I didn't understand why women weren't participating more in those early months. And it occurs to me that in some way that might have been an expression of this sort of reaction.
Tina, I'm trying to remember exactly. Now, I haven't done a close study, but I do remember Diane Sawyer standing up on top of the skyscrapers in New York looking over the hole in the ground. I mean, it wasn't as if there were not women in there.
No, no. And that's the sort of witness reporting that I don't think was so much affected. But the comments, the analysis, that's where I was missing the women's perspective of what this meant, because it seemed like it was an arena that belonged to a male world.
Do you think our interpretation, our response might have been different if more women had been doing the analysis, Tina?
Well, it's, you know, I don't want to speculate that way, but I did notice that this cultural gathering place that we now have is the media, where once we met at the Village Well, now we're meeting in our, you know, our TVs and our radios, were dominated by analyses and comments and the sharing of perspectives from the men's point of view. In part, it seemed because, you know, they're the traditional defenders of you know, culture and nationhood. And I'm sure it was a mutual response, too, because if women had come forward, I can't imagine they wouldn't have had the bandwidth. But, you know, I really don't know what the dynamics were that led to this, but it did surprise me.
Susan Faludi,
what
do you
say? Could I jump
in here?
Yes,
please, please.
Yes. And as the caller makes a very good point, it doesn't matter really whether women would change the conversation. Presumably, the more people you have, the more the conversation would be changed. But she's absolutely right that after 9/11, there was a dramatic drop-off in women's voices, both on op-ed pages and on the talk shows. The White House Project, which happened to be monitoring those crucial Sunday morning talk show programs, reported that in the first 7 weeks, the number of female guests shrank to by 40%. Even women who were crucial to the discussion, congressional heads of subcommittees dealing with terrorism, like Senators Feinstein and Boxer, were nowhere to be seen. In the Washington Post on September 12th, the opinion page was expanded to include 10 opinions instead of 5, supposedly to increase the diversity of opinion. Not one of them was a woman. In the weeks after 9/11, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times ran 88 op-ed pieces. Only 5 were by women. This repeated over and over and continued into the next year. Continues to this day. There are studies done by various groups that find women far outnumbered by male voices.
And are you describing that as women shoved to the rear, or American women somehow hypnotized by national myth, simply knowing because of something that happened on the American frontier that this was not their moment, and voluntarily sort of stepping back? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, this is also the role that verbal whipping of writers and pundits like Katha Pollitt or Susan Sontag had on other women who
Dixie
thought,
Chicks,
well,
sit down.
Why, exactly. And, you know, I mean, men and women both collaborate in this drama. It's not as if it's all men telling women that they can't talk. Women are doing this to themselves as well.
Let's get a call from Mark in Wilmantic, Connecticut. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom, Susan. Speaking of the national myth that she speaks of, it seems to me the role of women in the army, especially in Iraq, where women are in a daily combat role, and yet the national myth is that our women are behind the lines and aren't involved in combat, and reinforces that, that image that individually you may see one or two women raising like a Hillary Clinton, but the national myth or that, that image we have in our mind is that our women aren't out there on the front lines walking combat patrols or leading convoys down the road.
But they are, and we know it. So does that disprove or read against what Susan's saying or not?
No, I think it proves what Susan's saying, because though we know it, we still have an official policy that women can't be in combat roles and yet to fly and attack helicopters. We still have an official belief. I think it's part of the myth, the frontier myth of the country, that I think the great majority of Americans believe that women aren't in daily combat situations. I just got through reading the Band of Sisters book, and even I was unaware that women are flying attack helicopters, even though my own daughter is a JAG attorney in the Army.
Well, Mark, thanks for that. Susan Faludi, what about it? Is the reality yes. outpacing this myth, even as maybe it's still, you know, is the music in our minds? There's Hillary Clinton. There are the troops, female, on pretty much front lines, which are everywhere in Iraq. Is reality running ahead of what you're describing?
Well, no, this is the whole point that, I mean, to go back to the frontier period, women were defending themselves, as your visitor, Mona Sharon, who seemed to be speaking out of both sides of her mouth by saying we need manly virtues, and yet was saying, well, women were fighting Indians on the frontier. Indeed, they were.
Are those necessarily in conflict, those two? Manly virtues and womanly strength?
It's in conflict with the fantasy that we're of our leading, our reigning mythology that male strength is proven by rescuing frail women. We could have another mythology that said men and women together deal with the realities and the frailties and vulnerabilities of a society with their shared and mutual strengths. Going back to the military question, though, this is why the Jessica Lynch story was so crucial to us as a culture. It was a classic example of rewriting an experience to make it fit the myth. Jessica Lynch was a soldier who enlisted not once but twice. Yet the military and the media turned her drama from the service of a soldier into the rescue of a helpless little girl. I mean, we all remember how the first story we were handed, which was that special ops teams had battled their way into an Iraqi hospital after midnight to rescue Private Jessica Lynch from bloodthirsty Fedayeen death squads. Well, it turned out, thanks to reporting from the British media, that there was no battle. There were no death squads, as the military knew, because they had been informed of that. It was a bunch of doctors and nurses trying to take care of Lynch and actually trying to return her to the U.S. military.
And you describe this as the kind of contemporary equivalent of 19th century pulp fiction that made frontier men out to be heroes, even when they had failed.
And look at what they – and they also, the media, turned Jessica Lynch from a soldier into a helpless girl who, as the press kept reporting over and over again, loved pink when she was, a little girl. And the hordes of media went to her hometown in Palestine, West Virginia, to interview her kindergarten teachers and her school playmates. Moreover, an important part of the myth is that women be in danger, and of course, the greatest peril that can be imagined is sexual violation. So it was insinuated over and over again with Jessica Lynch, with no evidence that she had been sexually assaulted. This went on for months and months in the media. Meanwhile, no one gave voice to her own. It allowed her to give her own version of events. And when she finally was able to, she maintained, and I interviewed her, and she maintains to this day that she has no memory of this and doesn't think it happened.
Let's go to Alice in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice. You're on the air with Susan Faludi.
Thank you. I don't think this is a gender issue. I think we've missed the point in not everybody started blaming others for why it happened and wanting to fight back to get even. And no one stopped to say, why? why do they hate it? Why do they dislike us? What are we doing wrong? I think the male attitude would be to go out and fight, and a woman might say, why is this happening? But I think you're missing the point with all this fuss over feminism.
Susan, what do you say?
Well, one would hope that both men and women would want to know, why is this happening? I mean, that's what dropped out of our whole response, is looking practically and realistically at the actual event and figuring out a way to respond to the threat, the real threat, not the threat to our fantasy life. But instead of defending a nation, we were defending a myth.
But could it be that your own, I mean, you're bringing this prism so strongly to it, could that be cutting you off from looking at some of the very contemporary angles of this challenge, of this conflict? I mean, of course, national myth is powerful, but do we risk, you know, spending a lot of time thinking about King Philip's War in, you know, whatever it was, 1675, and missing what's going on in 2007?
You know, I don't think there's any danger we're going to waste a lot of time thinking about King Philip's War. Given the way our culture is, I think we're going to waste a lot more time thinking about Britney Spears. Yeah. But I'm not saying this is the reigning organizing principle. I'm saying this is one facet. This is one way of looking at it. And when we put on a feminist lens, we see things that we wouldn't see otherwise. And I think that's very important.
Let's take a call from Diane in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
So, Susan, I'm really looking forward to reading your new work. I'm a big admirer of yours, and I teach courses on gender violence, and I teach materials that you've written from before, and I think that this work is wonderfully consistent with, for example, Stift and the crisis of masculinity that you talk about there. I have a theory that I call the language of violence, and I think that the reenactment of the national myth of males speaking the language of violence is very alive and well. And the reaction to 9/11 that portrayed all the men as the heroes and the men as the speakers of the language of violence, especially in the military, and deciding what our national reaction was going to be was just ironclad.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth looking at that as kind of an organizing principle.
Yes, and in the book I go into great length looking at the male the language of male pundits and male reporters who, after 9/11, clearly felt compelled to essentially prove their chops by being as vigilante rhetoric as they could muster. So we had in Newsweek calls by a male commentator to reconsider the using torture in the Washington Post and Atlantic Monthly and the Wall Street Journal. We had male commentators saying that we needed to reconsider sort of bounty hunter kind of approaches, mercenary approaches, that we needed to think about secret prisons. We needed to think about sending terrorist detainees to countries that would torture them. In other words, even before the Bush administration revealed was forced to reveal its extraordinary rendition plans and its secret prisons, the CIA's secret prisons became a subject that we knew something about. The media was already paving the way, calling for this.
Susan, our time grows short, and I want to get to kind of where this all goes. Your epilogue is headlined, "What If?" And so what about it? What if? Question mark. What if it had been different? Let's say you're right. Let's say that the national myth sort of got us bound into particular gender roles at this time, and that had a lot to do with shaping our response. If that had been different, and I guess that means if women's voices, in your interpretation, had been more to the fore, what do you think might have been different?
Well, not just women's voices, but if we, as a people, had responded to the actual threat instead of retreating into this sort of kabuki drama of masculine dominance and feminine hysteria.
What would that have changed?
We would have dealt with the real problem. We would have honed an actual effort to improve national security, to create a working military strategy instead of being fed adolescent fantasies about amber alerts and missions accomplished and evildoers crushed. You know, and you saw a possibility of going a different way in the first weeks after 9/11, and particularly in New York, where people reached out to each other with compassion and solidarity. There was a sense of a communal sense that we're facing real frailties and vulnerabilities, and we have to grapple with that honestly. I was at the New York Historical Society recently for their 9/11 exhibit, which was mostly photographs and testimonies from ordinary Americans, mostly New Yorkers. And what was so striking was the call, both from men and women, for a solution that wasn't just, let's go in there and blow them all to smithereens.
Do you think Madame Condoleezza Rice is reading your book?
Oh, I have no idea, but I sense not. But I hope that those who really do want to spark a national discussion will take a look at it.
Susan Faludi's new book is The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America. She joined us from San Francisco. Susan, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.